So, in studying the quantumizing model, we have seen in practice, in action, that we have different phases that have very different behavior in the value of order parameters and in the way correlation functions behave. And the two phases are separated by a critical point that we have located at g equal 1. And at the critical point, we have seen that the gap between the first excited state and the ground state goes to zero. Okay? So the gaplessness of the model is associated to this critical behavior. In particular, we have argued, oh, at the critical point, because the inverse of the gap is like the correlation length, then correlation length and susceptibility diverge. And we kind of have used this criterion to distinguish different phases. So you remember from the beginning we said, oh, you know, a quantum phase is a domain of analyticity of our energy density. So we have something like this. This is some parameter space. This is lambda 1, this is lambda n. Okay? And maybe we have a line here. And we say, oh, this is the paramagnetic phase, this is a ferromagnetic phase in going from here to here across a critical point where delta is equal to zero. In the example of the Ising model, this happens on a line. So the whole manifold is just one line. But in the XY model, there is a two-dimensional phase diagram. So anyway, because we are forced to cross a critical point, then these must be two different phases. And let's think a little bit about this, because there is something strange about this definition that we have adopted until now, but a little bit more thought about it raises some questions. And before discussing the quantum case, I want to remind you a classical case, the case of water. This is the phase diagram of water, right? And here we have a point. It stops here, right? And here you have a solid. Here you have gas, vapor. Here you have water, liquid. And of course, to go from liquid to solid, we encounter a phase transition. We encounter a phase transition. And in principle, we encounter a phase transition in this way, and we say gas and liquid are two separate phases. However, what happens if I start from some vapor and I change pressure and temperature so that I circumnavigate this point? Then I never encounter a phase transition. So what happens to gas and liquid? Since I can go continuously, I never encounter any phase transition. So this is a domain of analyticity. And now let's think about the quantumizing model. Okay? So imagine that I have a new Hamiltonian, which is my Ising Hamiltonian with a parameter g. And now I add another term, B, sum over z. So now that I had this term, for g equals 0, remember g is the coupling with the sigma x. What is the ground state? So remember, before we had this term, the ground state was the span between 0, 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1. Right? Now I add this term to the Hamiltonian. What is the new ground state at g equals 0?
1, 1, 1, 1.
It's 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? It has become unique. And whereas at the beginning it's degenerate, so this, there is no gap between these two states, now there is a gap that is 2b. Between these two states. Right? So if we add this term, of course, things change. So now let's write this phase diagram. Now we have a G here and B here. This line is the quantumizing model. Here we have a critical point. But the new Hamiltonian lives in this space. We know that if I start here and I do this path, I encounter a quantum phase transition. But if I move like this, there is no gap, right? There is a gap that is increasing as 2b. Okay, now that there is a gap, I switch on g. And as I make g larger and larger, I do not close, actually, this gap. I do something like this. This can be proved. And then I go back down here in any way I want. And you see that I can go from the ground state of this Hamiltonian to the ground state of this Hamiltonian without encountering a QPT, because I opened a gap by adding a new term. Well, so is the ferromagnetic and the paramagnetic the same phase then? So either we say, you know what? It is the same phase. I was mistaken. Or we need to discharge our initial definition that a phase is a domain of analyticity of the free energy density, of the energy density in the quantum case. And you know, one could argue, okay, maybe in this case they are the same phase. We would only be concerned with phase diagrams that are of this nature, so that there is no way, right, of going from here to here. Well, how do you know? What if I insert another term in the Hamiltonian so that I enlarge my parameter space, and then again, from here to here, I can go without a phase transition? How do you know? How do you know that this line closes all the space? So you see, we have a problem here, right? So what do you think? What should we do? So in this case, what do you think about gas, vapor, and liquid water? Are they the same thing or not? What do you think?
After a certain temperature, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, liquid and gas are the same phase. Okay? We would like to explain why. So we really like to keep our criterion that a face is a domain of analyticity, but as you can see, there is some ambiguity. So in this case, we say, you know, I want to stick with my domain of analyticity, so definitely gas and liquid are in the same phase. But here we have a bit more trouble, because if there is one thing that we really want, is to maintain the distinction between ferromagnetic and paramagnetic. Because if we end up saying that these are the same phase, then, you know, OK, so what is all this about, right? Being spontaneously magnetic or not is a very big deal. And there are all these phenomena that we have described and we have computed, so there is something there. So somehow we need to update a little bit our notion of a domain of analyticity in some way. So where do you think is the problem? So should I, if I want to keep my notion of analyticity, then what can I do? Somehow I should forbid this thing, right? But of course, you know, we need a reason. We cannot say, oh, you know, we forbid it because they are in trouble. That's not a good reason. That's not a good reason. And physics is always about finding relationships between different facts. So one fact is that if we have this, we can go around. So we need a second fact. So we cannot, on the basis of one fact, say, OK, I don't like it. But we need a second fact, and that is in relationship with this. So what else does this term do?
It drives your order parameter.
OK, so this is our order parameter. You see, I put my order parameter in the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is a very good hint. So let's elaborate a little bit on this.
Selects a ground state?
Huh?
Selects a ground state?
It does select the ground state. In fact, it's the order parameter. The order parameter selects the ground state. You guys are saying the same thing. This is all very good. And what is the order parameter does? What is the fact? Why an operator is the order parameter?
Breaks the symmetry.
So you see now this Hamiltonian is not Z2 symmetric anymore. This is a term that does not commute with T, flipping all the spins. It's because it doesn't commute that can distinguish between these two, and therefore it's an order parameter. OK, so now we are on to something. Because when we move in the parameter G, we are preserving a symmetry. And then it's spontaneously broken. So the two phases are distinguished by the way they break a symmetry that we have imposed. If we add this, we break the symmetry explicitly. So the new notion of a phase is this. If you are allowed to break symmetries, then everything is the same. To the extent that we don't care about the symmetry, everything is the same. Remember that quantum many-body theory is about understanding what is important. So if for you, symmetry is not important, then the ferromagnetic and the paramagnetic are the same phase. But if you, for you, symmetry is important, then you all have to do your transformation preserving it, what is important for you. So you are stuck on this line. And then you encounter a phase transition. So a quantum phase is a domain of analyticity within what is important for you. And in this case, it's symmetry. Okay, so our vision of the world is that if I have here all the possible Hamiltonians with all the possible symmetries, then I would have all the possible symmetries of the Hamiltonian. And these are all already different phases. Then within one symmetry, say Z2, I have different ways of breaking them. So one is not breaking it, the other one is breaking it in this way. So in this way, so you have paramagnetic and ferromagnetic. And then you have other symmetries and other ways of breaking it. And if symmetry is what you care about, this classifies the world. And now we have a very interesting question, because until 1984, people thought that this picture is exhaustive, means that there are no other states that are ground states of Hamiltonians. So this means that if I disregard the symmetry, I could always go from one state to another state without encountering a critical phenomenon. That, in other words, symmetry and breaking of symmetry labels all the possible quantum states of quantum many-body systems. This belief had no basis. People were just so happy about the incredible success of this theory that all the quantum phases that we knew, all the phases of the matter that we knew, were labeled in this way. So it was taken for granted that this was the picture. And next week we'll see it's not true. It's not true. So there are other worlds. And we will see that. OK, so the first take-home message is it's a domain of analyticity within a symmetry. So phases, we say, are symmetry protected. Okay? It's symmetry that makes a phase. If you break the symmetry, you can go around. Okay. So this is the first lesson. The second lesson is, or actually the second question is, okay, so let's say that we impose a symmetry, so now we do not have this kind of ambiguity. And I'm saying that from here to here, something critical happens. And so far, we have identified this criticality in this criterion. Why? Because for the ISIM model, this is true. So at the critical point for the ISIM model, here we have long-range fluctuations. But there are two problems here. So the first problem is, why exactly, it is very interesting that long-range fluctuations are an interesting fact, but in what sense is critical? Well, we know that in the ISIM model, this marks the difference of symmetry, so it works. There is no contradiction. But in general, what's the point? Second, would it be possible that maybe the gap doesn't go to zero, or actually the gap goes to zero, and you still have something critical? So what really is, why should be fixated on the domain of analyticity of E? Just because we took it in the classical case. It could happen, and that's the point, it does happen. You have systems in which sometimes the gap closes, but nothing critical happens. They are rare, but they exist. But this means we have a problem. So we need a different definition of a phase and of criticality. So this splitting must be the splitting in something else. And today we explain a very operational and very meaningful way of distinguishing the phase. And it is exactly what we mean when we say there is a dramatic change. So instead of talking about correlation length and gaps, we go to a simpler notion. Here we have some phase, some states. And when I move like this inside here, this state change continuously in some sense that we will define. But when we cross here, at this point the change is dramatic. The change in the state. Of course I can go to this point if I disregard the symmetry in another way, which means that I have a smoother way to go to this point. It's the difference between going from one city to another by climbing up a very steep mountain or go around and being always in a valley, right? But the dramatic change is this steep climb that we need to do. Okay, so in order to do this, we need to say, to explain what is a dramatic change. In a quantum state. So this is our question. So first of all, before saying that it's dramatic, we really want to understand what is a change. So in other words, we want to find a metric between quantum states. How different two quantum states are. Okay, so this is a very interesting topic and it's very fundamental. And to attack it, we need to think a little bit about probability theory first. Why is that? Because being quantum mechanics, a probabilistic theory, because in the end, all that we observe are probabilities, we only care about the quantum states to the extent that these probabilities change. Otherwise, it's not something observable. Okay, so let's start with the probability distributions. Imagine I have two probability distributions, Px and Qx. So I say, you know, x are labels my space of events or my space of configurations, and this is the probability of x. And this is another probability distribution. And I want to define some metric between Px and Qx. We will see two examples because there are two ways of distinguishing probability distributions. So one is the so-called trace distance. So I will call it d. So the distance between Px and Qx is equal to 1/2 the sum over all the x's of Px minus Qx, absolute value. It's a very sensible, easy definition of a distance. By the way, D is actually, it is a metric because it is a symmetric, And it does obey the triangular inequality, meaning that the distance between P and Q is smaller than the distance between P, some order probability distribution Z, plus D between this order intermediate probability distribution and Q. Smaller than. Okay, so it is a metric. This distance has an operational meaning because one can prove, it's not too difficult, that if I consider all the subsets of labels X, and I consider the max over all these subsets of PS minus QS, so this is the probability of the event S, in other words. This holds. Why this is an operational meaning? So let's imagine we are playing poker, right? We're playing cards. And we have two decks. And one has a fair probability distribution. So Px is 1 over 52 for all the cards. And then we have the decks that they use in my hometown, in which you have 1 over 52 minus epsilon for all the x's that are not aces. And 1 over 52 plus 12 epsilon for x equal the aces. Okay. So now imagine that I want to distinguish these two probability distributions. So I'm given this deck to play, and I want to know if it's a good deck or it's another type of deck. Okay. So what happens if I look at the frequency of having a pair? Or having a full house, I cannot distinguish them. But if I look at the frequency of having four aces, then I can distinguish these two. So you see, there are some events, some S's, namely having a full house, that do not tell apart these two decks, but other events, like when S is having four aces, that tells them apart. So the maximum of all these combinations, of all these events, is the distance between the two probability distributions. Okay. There is a second distance that is very interesting. And it's very interesting, although it's a bit more complicated to understand what it is. It's called fidelity. And it's this quantity, I call it F, the fidelity between Q and P, is just the sum of the square root of Px Qx. So, you know, this is not a metric. You know, you see that if P is equal to Q, actually this thing can be 1. So there, it's not a distance. And it's not even, doesn't obey the triangular inequality. So it's not a metric, but it's a way. So if there is high fidelity between Q and P, means that they're close, otherwise they're not. The meaning is a bit more complicated, but I want to explain it. Let's make first an example with the two coins. So imagine that I have the coin 1 that has a probability distribution P and 1 minus P. There are only two events, right? The two faces of the coin. Coin 1 and coin 2, Q and 1 minus Q. Okay. And I throw them n times, so this is the number of trials. And I look at the variance of my distribution of the outcomes. And one can compute from the binomial distribution that this is just p, 1 minus p over n, and similarly for q. So we would have two distributions. Let me do like this. Okay? So this is delta p, this is delta q. Okay. And this is the distance between the two maxima. So what happens if the if p plus q, is it p plus q? Yeah. Is smaller than the sum of the two variances. Well, then I cannot distinguish them. Okay? So somehow, our criterion to distinguish them is that they are more apart than this quantity. Let me make the simplification that for coins that are not too different, their variances are actually very similar, so I can just use this criterion. Okay? So now imagine that I have two distributions that definitely are very far apart. And I want to quantify how much is this distance. Well, what I could do is this. Let me find a probability distribution that is similar to this, but it is just about, so this distance is this, the sum of these two. And then another one, and then another one, and I count them. So it's the number of the intermediate probability distributions that are distinct. If I do it continuously, I can say that this distance between the initial p and the final q, now take this as a definition. This is all heuristics to make you understand the concept, is the sum of how many of this dp over this distance we have. So this is 2 square root p 1 minus p. And this is, if you do the integral, the cosine, arcosine of square root of pq plus 1 minus p, 1 minus q. If instead of having a coin, you have a distribution px that has many different outcomes, we can define in general the distance between p and q as the arcosine of the sum over x of the square root of px qx. Oh, and what is this? It's the fidelity. So it's the cosine to the minus 1 of f. So we see why f enters. Yes?
Should the sum sign be inside the square root then?
Right, so I should, what's the question?
The sum sign, should it be inside the square root? Because the like two versions, the sum is inside the square root.
I see. So I think I was wrong here. Okay. Okay, so this is the distance, and we will use this. Okay, for us, a distance between probability distribution is given by the arccosine of the fidelity. Okay, finally, we can go to quantum states. Okay, because in some sense, quantum states are probability distribution. And in what sense? We said that the first day, we start, what we measure are observables, are operators. And they can be written as a linear combination of their eigenvalues onto, let me see the notation I'm using here, phi I a. These are the projectors onto their eigenvectors. And as we said, if we are in a state psi 1, being in this state means that the probability of finding the outcome A in the state 1 when I measure A, remember, is given by this thing. Or the trace of phi I A psi 1. Remember that. Okay. So we assign probability distributions to states by measuring observables. Okay. Now, there's something weird here, though, that when I'm given a probability distribution in a classical probability distribution, I give you the space of configurations is x, and to x is assigned px. And here, I give you my state, right? My space of configurations with the probability, which is the state, and I get this probability when I measure A. So it seems it depends on A. So what happens if instead of measuring A, I measure B? So let's measure B, and let's first do this case that A and B commute. So if A and B commute, this means that B can be written as a spectral resolution of some eigenvalues B in the same projectors of A, right? They commute, so they have a common basis of eigenvectors. So you see that when I compute the probability of having the outcome BI when I measure B in the state 1, this will be the trace of psi 1 phi IA is the same. Oh, this is nice. Okay, so we don't have to worry. It doesn't matter. The underlying probability distribution is the same no matter what I look at. But what happens when this is different from zero? If this is different from zero, then these are different eigenvectors. So these are different. And this means that this probability, the underlying probability distribution in my space of configuration, is different from this one. So given a state, we do not have one probability distribution. We have different probability distributions. And this is all because of this. So if you feel that this is weird, well, welcome to quantum mechanics. There is not one underlying probability distribution of your particles from which we compute expectation values. That's why they are not classical. Quantum mechanics is not just a probabilistic theory. It's a probabilistic theory where the probability distributions of different things are not compatible. And that's why the commutator not being zero is the landmark of quantum mechanics and says, oh, we have non-compatible measurements. It's exactly this. They describe the system in two completely different ways that are not compatible. All right, then. So if I want to now distinguish, I will need to erase this. If now I have two states, two quantum states, psi 1 and psi 2, they gave me probability distributions. P of big in the state 1, when I measure A of the event I, and P when I measure I and you are in the state 2, sorry, P when I measure A of the event I, when I am in the state 2. And now I want to distinguish psi 1 and psi 2. Okay? So my distance between psi 1 and psi 2, since now I have a probability distributions, I can just say, oh, you know what? Is the cosine to the minus 1 of the sum of these guys, right? The trace of phi I A psi 1 times the trace of phi I A psi 2, or in other words, cosine to the minus 1, the sum of phi I A psi 1 modulus times modulus phi I A psi 2. Okay. So borrowing my, this is the distance between the two probability distributions. And I could call this the distance between the two states. However, we have a problem, because I've chosen here the probability distributions coming from A. So in what sense? I cannot use that as distance between the states, because this is arbitrary. So I have to say, OK, it is this. It depends on A. But now I can think, OK, wait a second. Just like before, I was distinguishing in the trace distance, I was trying to find the event that maximally distinguishes two probability distribution. Now I could do the same thing here. I could say that my true distance is the one obtained by trying all the possible observables and taking the soup. So now this does not depend on A anymore. I find the best observable such that distinguishes the two probability distribution. Yeah?
It's not quite clear to me that the first method is independent of the choice of basis X.
This first method?
Yeah.
In this first method, there is no state vector here. This is, we have two classical probability distributions. There is no state vector.
Okay,
these are classical probability distributions. The point in quantum mechanics is that probability distributions, now this is a probability distribution, but they come from measuring A. And the weird thing is that in the same state, if I measure A or I measure B, I get two different probability distributions. OK, so we take the soup. And when you take the soup, it is easy to see. Let me erase this. That the best A to discriminate between psi 1 and psi 2 is the projector onto psi 1 or the projector onto psi 2. So I can choose an A. So this is the A max, the best one. It's some eigenvalue times the projector onto psi 1 plus any other orthogonal terms. All these measurements realize the maximum in this distance. So if I put it here, I will find the cosine to the minus 1 of the modulus between psi 1 and psi 2. See, the modulus of the overlap. And this is what is called quantum fidelity. Since it came from borrowing the definition of fidelity of probability distributions. So you see, now we have an expression that does not depend on the observable anymore. The distance between quantum states is the angle between two states. Very well. Now,
question.
Yeah.
How did you get that last equality?
By inserting, knowing that this is the soup of all these quantities. This is the value of A that gives you the soup of all these quantities. Because I just project onto psi 1. OK. Now, imagine that now we have two states, psi 1 and psi 2. We have states such that their fidelity is almost one, okay? Two states that are very close to each other. Then this means that this number, cosine to the minus one, is very small. So we can expand cosine minus of f and write something that is 2, 1 minus f, okay? So this is the distance between two states when they are very close. It's the differential. I call it dfs. It's the infinitesimal distance between two quantum states. And this one is called Fubini-Studi metric. It's a differential in the sense of calculus. And it is a metric. Now, consider the equivalent of the trace distance for quantum states. Okay? Because remember, we had for probability distributions, we had both the fidelity, f, and the trace distance. So the distance between two quantum states, rho and sigma, regardless of whether they're pure or mixed, is 1/2 the trace of rho minus sigma in the one norm. I remind you that the one norm of something is the square root of of this something dagger itself. OK, so this is the trace distance. Now it turns out that when rho and sigma are pure, then d rho sigma is equal to the square root of 1 minus f squared. So this is a theorem that one can prove. And you see that then in the quantum case, the two ways of measuring distances are actually compatible. They are the same. Another interesting property is that the distance between rho and sigma, in general, can be written like the max over all the projective measurements, so when our observable is a projector, between the expectation value of rho in that projector and the expectation value of sigma in that projector. So the overlap between quantum states that gives you the fidelity, so it's the minus the distinguishability, is connected in this way to the trace distance, where the trace distance is the most discriminating measurement that I can do. You see, it's the best difference in a measurement, p, that I can find between being in rho and being in sigma. This is completely operational. I have two states, and I try to find the measurement such that the expectation value of one measurement, the expectation value of the other measurement are the most far apart. That is the distance, the trace distance between two quantum states. And it is connected to the overlap of the states by this form. At this point, you could ask me the following question. Okay, why among all these ways of looking at distances between quantum states, you didn't choose something like this? I have phi and psi. I take the difference, and then I take the norm of this difference in any norm that you want, whether it's the one norm or the operator norm, doesn't matter. You know, it seems that if these two states are the same, this goes to zero. So why this is not good?
By a phase, they don't zero. If there is a phase different, they are zero.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, the phase. Because remember, our quantum states are not the vectors in the Hilbert space, are the rays. What is a ray? It's this. It's the equivalence class of all these vectors for every alpha. Differential geometry is called the fiber over the set of vectors in the Hilbert space. So this means that if phi, I transform it in this way, I have a different vector, but I have the same quantum state. Right? So I could substitute phi with this, because it's still the same quantum state. And here I could put a phase beta, and it's still the same quantum state. And now you see that this difference, the norm of this difference, depends on alpha and beta. So that doesn't work, because it's not a distance between quantum states. However, I could take the sup over all the alphas and betas, and have something that does not depend on alpha and betas. I don't know what that means, but it works. Beautiful theorem. When you take the sup, it's a complicated theorem, you get this.
So if you take the sup, then if they're the same states, then you wouldn't get zero, right? Because you're trying to maximize the...
If I take the sup,
and they're the same states?
Oh, sorry. then I need to take the inf, sorry. So there is not another way. This is the way of distinguishing quantum states. So what happens now? Okay, now we know what is a distance between quantum states. So what do we do for our quantum phase transitions? And this is the subject of what we discussed this afternoon. But we do this. We have Hamiltonians that depend smoothly on a set of parameters lambda, lambda 1, lambda n. So let this square be some region of these parameters. So this is lambda 1, this is lambda n. Okay. In a point here, we have one choice of lambda. We diagonalize the Hamiltonian, and we find the ground state. Psi 0 of lambda. Okay. Now, this ground state lives on some manifold that is parameterized by lambda. Now, imagine, and now I want to understand, for this manifold, what is this distance dfs, which is 2, 1, minus f? What is it? So this is our goal. And what we will find is that on this manifold, this object is a Riemannian tensor. So suddenly, our space of quantum ground states becomes a curved manifold in the space of quantum states with curvature, with everything that you like to do, like over there. And then we will see what are the critical points.